Thanks for listening to Up First. We want to know who's listening and how you're using podcasts.
Please help us out by completing a short anonymous survey at npr.org/podcastsurvey, one word. It takes less than 10 minutes and really helps us out.
That's npr.org/podcastsurvey.
2 months after another unarmed black man is killed, finally, arrests this week in Brunswick, Georgia, and a rally to honor the life of Ahmaud Arbery, the young man shot while he was out jogging. I'm Lulu Garcia Navarro.
And I'm Scott Simon, and this is Up First from NPR News. Two men in Georgia, a father and son, are arrested for killing Arbery. Authorities finally acted after a graphic video of the shooting surfaced online. We'll have reaction from Georgia.
And parts of the U.S. are reopening, and some public health experts worry a second surge of infections is inevitable. We'll hear about their concerns.
And hard numbers for coronavirus infections are hard to come by, so in Corvallis, Oregon, researchers are going door to door.
So stay with us. We'll give you the news you need to start your weekend.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from BetterHelp, online counseling by licensed professional counselors specializing in isolation, depression, stress, and anxiety. Visit BetterHelp.com/upfirst to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
Support for NPR comes from Trello, part of the Atlassian Collaboration Suite. During these uncertain times, Trello is here to help teams work together to solve big challenges. Trello helps teams communicate, focus, and connect. Try Trello for free and learn more at Trello.com.
In Brunswick, Georgia, hundreds of people turned out for a rally to honor and celebrate the life of Ahmaud Arbery. He's the black man who was out jogging when he was shot and killed in February.
It wasn't until this week when cell phone video of the altercation became public that Georgia authorities arrested and charged a white father and son in his death. We're joined now by Georgia Public Broadcasting's Emily Jones, who was at the rally. Emily, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The suspects had been arrested the night before. What were people at the rally calling for?
So yesterday would have been Arbery's 26th birthday. So the rally was really part a celebration of his life and also celebrating the fact that two people had been arrested in his death. Remember that Arbery was jogging through a neighborhood and the suspects saw him and thought he might have been involved in some recent break-ins. So they got their guns, hopped in a pickup truck, and confronted him as he jogged along this residential street. A struggle happened and he was shot. The local district attorney had to recuse herself because one of the suspects had actually worked in the office as an investigator. And then a second DA recused himself at the request of Arbery's family. Then a third DA just this week asked the Georgia Bureau of Investigation to take over the case when that cell phone video was leaked publicly. 2 days later, state authorities arrested the men. With all of that as the backdrop, people came out to this rally yesterday, including Shamia Hines.
Several incidents have occurred that have been covered up, and I hate that this had to happen to Ahmaud, for the city to come out, for it to reach the nations, for everything to be brought to light.
Emily, did the people that you met feel that with the arrest, justice has been done?
No, they view the arrests as just one part of what's expected to be a lengthy court case. It took 10 weeks from the point when Arbery was shot to when the arrests happened, even though authorities knew on day one who shot him because the suspects admitted it. There's also just distrust of police in this community on Georgia's coast. There have been other instances where people thought that police protected their own. And also, there are racial tensions, and some people just don't feel safe. Ryan Marshall was holding a sign at the rally that said, "Would you have shot me?" He told me he often runs through Brunswick neighborhoods with his 9-year-old son.
I can say, as an African-American in the place and the world that we live in, there's been times where, you know, I have looked around and had to make sure people weren't running behind me or looking at me any type of way or had any ill intentions, yes.
I gather, Emily, that running was a big part of Ahmaud Arbery's life, and it was also part of the celebration yesterday.
Yeah, it was. All across the country, people participated in a special run to honor him. The hashtag #IRunWithMaud was actually trending. People ran 2.23 miles. That's in reference to February 23rd, the date that he was killed. People from NFL players to just regular people taking pictures of their fitness trackers took to the streets to run or walk on Arbery's behalf. I even saw one person who planned out their route so that a picture of the map actually spelled out Maud on it.
With two arrests being made, is the Georgia Bureau of Investigation done with the case?
No, apparently not. At a news briefing yesterday, the director of the GBI said they are still looking into other aspects of the case and may make further arrests. It's unclear at this point who that might be. As of now, though, the father and son suspects remain in jail being held without bail.
Emily Jones, Savannah Bureau Chief of Georgia Public Broadcasting, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So in Texas, you can get into a tanning bed. In Indiana, houses of worship have no cap for prayer services.
And President Trump continues to push for the country to open up.
But public health experts are sounding the alarm. NPR's Leila Fadel has been talking to some and joins us now. Hi, Leila.
Hi.
So it's been 7 long weeks of lockdown. If I wanted a haircut, which I do, could I get one now?
Well, you can in a couple places like Georgia or Texas, but the experts say you shouldn't. Mm. Let your hair grow a little longer, cut it yourself. They say they worry that even though the curve is flattening in parts of the country, some states even showing a decline, there are a number of states where cases are actually on the rise.
And yet we're seeing this thing where a majority of states are beginning to ease restrictions. Why are they doing that if the numbers show that cases are on the rise?
Well, every state is taking a different approach. And while polls show that people are overwhelmingly supportive of stay-at-home orders, there's a lot of pressure to get the economy up and running. New York is still shut down. And then you've got California taking it a lot slower than some places. So this week, curbside pickup at some non-essential businesses like florists is allowed or outdoor recreation. But the governor is leaving the decision on whether to implement that lifting of restrictions up to individual county leaders. And then you've got places like Georgia, as I mentioned before, where getting a tattoo is allowed, and the governor's executive order to reopen these types of businesses supersedes local leaders. I asked the health director in DeKalb County, Sandra Elizabeth Ford, if she's concerned about the governor's decision.
Yeah. It's a decision out of my hands. All we can do is try to make sure that people are as educated as possible and that they realize that opening the state does not mean lifting the requirements on self-protection and protection of others.
Well, she sounds concerned. What do the public health experts say is the right approach?
Look, they don't want to see a second surge of infections that overwhelm hospitals. And a lot of the reasons we didn't see hospitals overwhelmed in other parts of the country the way New York was is because of social distancing and these strict orders to stay home and only go out for essential purposes. So they're worried. Caitlin Rivers of Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security told a House Appropriations Subcommittee this week that none of the states meet the criteria that her center laid out for them before reopening. Now, not all states adopted these criteria, but they are guidelines. A 14-day decline in cases, the ability to contact trace, a healthcare system that can safely care for patients, including personal protective gear for healthcare workers, and rapid diagnostic testing. And again, she says no state meets that criteria and told the subcommittee right now is a critical time.
We risk complacency in accepting the preventable deaths of 2,000 Americans each day. We risk complacency in accepting that our healthcare workers do not have what they need to do their jobs safely. And we risk complacency in recognizing that without continued vigilance, we will again create the conditions that led to us being the worst affected country in the world.
So does this mean we're looking at more infections and possibly more deaths?
Yes, it could. The latest model from the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation now says nearly 135,000 people will die by August. And that model is based on some of those restrictions being eased.
That's NPR's Leila Fadel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are no hard numbers for just how many people in the United States are currently infected with the coronavirus. But at Oregon State University, they've launched a project to change that, at least for one small city.
NPR's Joe Palca is here to tell us about the goals of the project. Joe, thanks for being with us.
You bet.
What are the Oregon State researchers trying to do?
Well, they're trying to find something called the prevalence of the virus in Corvallis, Oregon. That is how many people are infected at a particular point in time. And that means going out and finding out if people are carrying the virus, taking a nasal swab or in some cases a nasopharyngeal swab where you get the back of the throat to. In this case, it's just a nasal swab. And they then take that glop, essentially, back to the lab and test to see whether it has any indication that the virus DRNA, genetic material, is in there. Now, most of the people who are tested in this country are either sick or in some special category like healthcare worker or nursing home attendant. But it would be good to know how many people in the population are infected because there could be people infected and not know it and be spreaders. So the prevalence tells you that. It also helps you get a handle on whether the outbreak is waning if the prevalence drops from week to week.
Well, how do they figure that out? Because I'm assuming they don't, or they certainly can't test all 58,000 residents of Corvallis.
No, that would be impossible. What they do is they, like a census, essentially, they take what they think is a representative sample, and then teams go door to door, and they ask people to participate. And if they say yes, they get a swab. They actually do the swab themselves, hand it back to the team member who in a tube, and then they take that back to the lab. If this were strictly a research effort, researchers wouldn't reveal the results to the participants. But that's how research is done. It's anonymized. But in this case, the organizers wanted to provide people with what could be useful information.
And what are they finding, Joe?
Well, they only have one weekend's worth of data so far. This is going to be the third weekend they've gone out. But for the weekend of 25th, 26th April, they looked at 237 households, 455 people tested. And from the results so far, they say 2 in 1,000 are infected, or 0.2%.
And that's for a single point in time, right?
That's right. That was just for that weekend. But even that level, and I know it sounds a little low, can be problematic. Here's Ben Diel of Oregon State, who led the project.
2 in 1,000 is a sufficient level of prevalence that if we were to reopen too quickly, we would risk entering another epidemic exponential growth phase.
So Diel says expanded testing efforts like his will be important to help officials know when it's safe to reopen a community and catch flare-ups should they occur.
NPR's Joe Palca, thanks so much.
You bet.
And that's Up First for Saturday, May 9th, 2020. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up First is back Monday with news to start your week. There are also special episodes in this feed from time to time. You can follow us on social media anytime. We're at Up First on Twitter.
And you can tune us in
on your radio, weekend edition, Saturday and Sunday mornings. Find your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
There's a lot going on in the world right now. You ever just feel like you want to talk it all out? Well, I'm here to help. My name is Sam Sanders. I host NPR's It's Been a Minute. Each week on my show, a bunch of smart guests and I talk about the news and the culture without making you feel overwhelmed. Join us every Friday on It's Been a Minute from NPR.